The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. William Cleveland, our author tonight of this wonderful book, Art and Upheaval, Artists on the World's Front Line, is the founder and director of the Center for the Study of Art and Community. His 25-year history producing arts programs in cultural, educational, and community venues also includes his leadership of the Walker Art Center's Education and Community Programs Department, California's Arts and Corrections Program, which is where I first met Bill, and the California State Summer School of the Arts. His other book, Art in Other Places, chronicles 22 model programs developed by artists and community development service providers in 17 American communities. Bill is also a professional musician and a songwriter, and he's toured all over the U.S. and Canada, and I don't know whether or not he will break out in song tonight, but it's possible. In conversation with Bill tonight is Susan Hill, an L.A. artist. Susan's had a profound influence on the arts in this community and beyond. Since the 1980s, Susan has produced projects and teaching programs both as artist in residence and as an arts administrator. She served for 2 decades as California's director of Arts Reach, which partnered with California's statewide creative fine arts program, Arts in Corrections. I know there's some people in the room who worked in that program. It placed artists primarily in prisons in the state of California. You will hear more about that tonight in the conversation. Susan Hill and Bill Cleveland are longtime collaborators and co-conspirators, advocates for the power of art as a force for social change. Tonight, as they discuss Bill's new book, Art and Upheaval, Artists on the World's Front Line, you'll hear about the power and persistence of the human spirit in places as far-flung as Watts, Belfast, Soweto, Phnom Penh, and Sarajevo. Please welcome William Cleveland and Susan Hill to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
But men in prison are all just living for others they long to hold, because their fathers and some husbands and brothers each has someone outside waiting for him to be free again when the gates swing open wide.
Thank you.
So, you gonna tell us where the hell that came from?
Yeah, actually, and the link between that and this book is that the gentleman who wrote that song, his name is Vern McKee, who was one of the seminal artists in the creation of the Arts and Corrections Program. By the time I met him, he had spent 20 years at the California Medical Facility in Vacaville, and he was the founder of the Visual Arts Guild and the Musicians Guild, and in fact convinced Eloise Smith, who was the mother of the Arts and Corrections Program, that not only did they deserve support for all of their art making, but that she would be a co-conspirator in the saving of numerous lives if that investment was made. And the reason I invoked Vern's spirit here on the stage is, number one, is to bring his spirit back with us. I like to bring some of my colleagues with us, even whether they're alive or not with us. The other is that what he taught me eventually led to the writing of this book and the other books that I've written. He was one of my mentors and teachers, and he taught me, I think probably more than anybody, that if you want straight answers about the power of the creative process, you go to the place where it is most needed. And Vern understood that indelibly. And he gave us straight answers. And that song is one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. You can tell perhaps maybe that Bill and I have known each other for a long, long time. You'll see us trade stuff back and forth. And I will tell you that given what we've been talking about, if Bill could cook for you tonight, he would cook for you as well. And it would be a great treat because there is an alliance, we believe, in feeding the soul that comes from the creative process and the food that's given to you with hands laid on. It's my pleasure tonight to be here with Art in Upheaval. I'm still kind of getting over the song, which we love, and Vern McKee, which we love. And one of the great ties to the book, I think, is that Vern McKee was doing time and that he asked someone in power to give them clay so that they continue to make art. And the woman in power, whose name is Eloise Smith, whose family went on to found the William James Association, which really was the founder of the Arts and Corrections Program. Mm-hmm. But she said yes, and you will see those kind of collaborators in this book. Mm-hmm. And that the artists came absolutely they were at the place of the wound. They are the people who are living there. They are the people who have the medicine. And it's what we'll talk about. Art in Upheaval is extraordinary in that it comes from the voice that is the artist. Bill listened really well. He's a master at asking questions. The book is almost a seamless interweaving of the history of the place and the political times with reportage and interviews and Bill being there in person. So as you read the book, you are really transported around the world in time and in place. And we would like to invoke the people of this book. And if I could ask you to do that recitation.
Yeah. In writing this book, I mean, one of the interesting things is that when I started, I knew that they were there, the artists in every community in the world that was facing some degree of extreme upheaval. Who they were exactly, I did not know. I knew some of them. But when I basically sort of touched the live wire that was connected to all those people, I was jolted because in just 2 months of preliminary research, I came up with over 500 potential subjects for this book. My goal with writing it was to move sort of beyond the once upon a time there was an artist and they did great work and terrific stuff happened. It's to really go into great depth and to provide the ground cover, cover the planting of the seeds, look at how the seeds were nourished, watch the harvest and see the seasons as they move from one to another. So in many cases, the sweep of history that exists in these is 30 or 40 years. So I had to pick very judiciously, as you can imagine. So the six stories that rose up, and I have to say they practically picked themselves, the first story was from Northern Ireland, about an amazing cross-community theater work called The Wedding that was about mixed marriages in the course of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. Another important story was a theater company called Da, which means whisper in Serbo-Croatian. And Da's work was precipitated by a 12-year period of time in the dissolution of Yugoslavia and all of the wars and all of the lies and all the betrayals and all the corruption that occurred in the course of that And here's a theater company that basically devoted themselves to really telling truth to power in a very dangerous environment. Another amazing story came from Cambodia. And that sweep of history begins in the late 1960s and moves all the way up into present time and follows the sweep of history that includes in some small part American involvement in Vietnam, but also obviously Cambodia. And the attempt after the fact of the Khmer Rouge, who were only in power for 3 years but managed to kill 95% of all of the living artists in Cambodia, an oral culture, okay, if you can imagine. And the attempt to actually rebuild that 900-year-old oral culture through an organization called RAYM. South Africa, probably the most obvious subject here, and a number of stories, both pre- and post-apartheid, many dealing with not only issues of justice, but also issues of poverty and AIDS, which is something that is a major thing in South Africa. One of the most unlikely stories takes place in the desert of Australia, where unbeknownst to many people, including Australians, the British decided that they needed to, in the wake of World War II, needed to have an atomic bomb. And they certainly weren't going to test it in Great Britain, so they picked a land which was occupied by the Pijinjara people, nomadic people, indigenous people of that area. And there are numerous stories that we tell in the book about how that happened and what came out of it. And amazingly, the contemporary artwork that is there to try and surface the silenced story of the bombing and poisoning of this massive area of Australia that's the size of Rhode Island. And of course, last but not least, the favorite sons of Los Angeles, the Watts Prophets, and their story, which begins prior to the 65 rebellion and moves to the current moment. And who are still all alive and well and really doing great work. Those are the characters stage.
Those are the walking spirits for the book. And like any other, as Bill said, they are representative of the work that's going on probably around the world. And as I read the book, I was struck with a couple of things. And one thing that kept coming back to me is somebody that you actually mentioned in the book, who is LA's own Jack Jackson, mm-hmm. of the Inner City Cultural Center, who at the time of the bicentennial said that in a speech that come the turn of the century, that things were really going to be in bad shape. There was going to be a tremendous amount of chaos. There was going to be loss of vision. The old ways were not going to work. And that, see, what is going to be required is a new form of leadership and that is infused with creativity. It has got to have vision. And he was telling artists at that point to begin to accept the responsibility to take on that vision and to work for change. And that thread seems to run through this book for artists who just were going to take responsibility for the chaos, for the wounding, for the rupture, the oppression that was at work where they lived. Certainly it's true of the Watts Prophets.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think that's easy to do when you encounter these kinds of stories from afar is, you know, you compare somebody who wakes up every morning and decides to go to a studio to work 12 hours to make art that in the end will very likely never be seen, and the greater likelihood would be that you would end up in jail. Now, what possesses a person to do that? I mean, I think that's an important question for anybody here who is either an artist or just anybody who's, what is this taking responsibility thing? As I encounter these stories, in many ways it was similar to my going into prison. I had a stereotype of what you know, what kind of psyche would be predisposed to do this? Of course, everything I had in my mind was dispelled over and over and over again. And one of them was, is that none of these people felt that they ever had a choice. They understood that they were making choices. And one of them actually described to me and said, so you live in a village where there's no food. You have one meal every couple of days. You have two children to feed. Is it heroic to go out and find food to feed your children? And that was exactly the way they perceived their work as creators, is that they were, in fact, contributing to the lifeblood of the survival of themselves, their community, their nation. And it was what they did. And it's interesting. The other book, Art in Other Places, most of the, because it took place in the United States, most of the people, most of the characters in that book chose to do this work consciously. They could have not done the work, and they could have not engaged the subjects, the territories, the geography of the places that they worked. Obviously, many of the people in this book, they weren't leaving. And they woke up every day, and one way or another, the troubles was, you know, once you got the sleepies out of your eyes, the troubles was in your face. If you were in Phnom Penh and you're living in a Khmer Rouge camp, you know, you woke up early and you went out and you dug ditches. If you were one of the Pijinjara people, or if you were a nuclear veteran from Australia affected by this terrible event, you know, in the late 50s, you're likely looking in the eyes of people who were genetically mutated as a result of this action. So the separation of people's lives from the stories they were trying to tell, the subject matter, and the making of art was impossible. In many ways, it's sort of like coming upon a tribe of people who completely understood that there was no separation between the manifestation of the creative process and living and breathing and eating and surviving as a human being in desperate circumstances. And I cannot tell you what a privilege that was over 8 years of going to those places.
I'm going to do two things right now.
All right.
Okay. Pisces, two directions. First of all, we forgot something.
Mm-hmm.
Because Vern came out. Mm-hmm. We forgot to ask who's
in
the audience.
That's right. Yes.
My apologies. Because I know, actually, I recognize some faces here. There are some people who really do this work. Because there's Judy, and there's Lydia, and there's Karen, and there's Beth, and there's Will, and there's Sheila. And past that, that's just folks I know. But past that, who else here works in the arts? Or who else here works in the community level? What do you do?
Education manager for Los Angeles Opera.
Wow, okay. And what do you do?
I'm also at the Opera.
Okay.
Taking programs to schools.
Okay. And this fellow in the green shirt?
I work for a foundation. We've done a lot of arts programs.
Okay. Over here? Yes.
I'm an art teacher that volunteers with art programs.
Okay. In the city of LA? Okay. And who comes to the arts programs?
Children from the community at the art centers come to the arts. The Grant Stills Center.
Oh, yeah.
Barnsville Center.
Oh, yeah.
The OLA program.
Oh, yeah. Part of LA program. Okay. All right. Who else had a hand up? Yes. Yes.
I do creative writing.
Amazing. Did you all hear that? She does creative writing with Women at Center for Homeless Women, yes? Yes.
There's that woman in Orange.
Oh, the woman in orange. Community schools. Yes. Would you say that again a little more slowly? Yes. In Orange County, excellent. Yes. Excellent. It's a part of what we're really interested in who's here. The part of the belief that goes through this is that the creative spirit lives in all of us. It is what connects us in terms of humanity. There are certainly people here who contribute on a daily basis to the beauty around us. And we know it's a hard fight. We know that. So thank you. And is there anybody else that wants to? I mean, you will have time at the end, but we... Who am I missing?
There
oh, back there. Yes. Okay. Good. Storytellers in the house. The other thing I was going to ask, speaking of storytelling, is if you just it can give us an example. I mean, there are extraordinary things that happened. You know, what happened in Cambodia? What happened when he went home? You know, what happened in South Africa, particularly around the visual arts that went into the government building? What do you want to? Which story do you want to tell us?
I think a very interesting story, and I'm going to invoke another spirit. One was an old one. This is a new one, and it's kind of a tragic one, but it's important. Gabisile Nkosi is a young woman who grew up in Soweto, and Umlazi, which is another of the townships near Durban. And she grew up with a dream that manifested on a daily basis with pieces of paper and pencils and drawings. And she drew her heart out. The school she went to actually had one of the teachers who had some background in the arts and pulled her aside and decided, we're gonna feed this thing as much as we can. And slowly but surely, her trajectory and the historic trajectory of South Africa started to move together. And at the point that she became really proficient enough to go get some advanced training, something had happened in South Africa. You may have heard about it. A guy named Nelson Mandela was elected president. Apartheid was shifted, and all of the institutions of South Africa started to go through a... And actually, most people think that it was, so the ANC becomes the government, everything changes. No, it doesn't. The change is slow and very painstaking, and it still goes on. So when she first tried to get herself into a university, she was disqualified 3 times in a row, each time for her lack of English proficiency, the second time for both lack of English proficiency and the lack of an appropriate portfolio, and finally, lack of funding. She eventually got in. She was that persistent. And at the Technicon that she went to, she shined. She did amazing work. She met a man named Jean Jordan, and Jan actually saw that she was a brilliant young artist and enlisted her in the creation of a public process that celebrated the new Bill of Rights in South Africa. The Bill of Rights of South Africa is a little different than ours. It actually manifested as a result of the people of South Africa sending in their ideas about what should be in it. It ended up with 27 articles. If you look at the articles, if you read them, you'll see that its reputation for being one of the most progressive, most advanced Bill of Rights and constitutions in the world is well-deserved. But, and actually I have a quote here, people understood that in the over the course of apartheid, written words on paper would only go so far, because so many words on so many pieces of paper seem to say one thing and have something else happen in reality. And so they decided that they were going to make images for each of the 27 articles. And Gabby was enlisted, commissioned to do one of those images. Those images now are etched in glass in the Constitutional Court of South Africa, which, amazingly enough, it is the Supreme Court of the land. But if you were standing in the middle of it right now, you would think you were in the middle of an amazing art gallery. Everything about the building is a piece of art, including the place where the justices sit. It's an incredible place. And one of the reasons that it is that way is because the justices insisted that there be symbols that personified ideas, not just words. And this is what Desmond Tutu said about the reason why the art making was so important to the process of moving into the new South Africa through their Bill of Rights. The images, he's speaking of these images in the portfolio of this 27 articles. The images powerfully complement the words of the Bill of Rights. Given our history, they serve as an apt reminder that words, however inspiring and lyrical, have been used as much to subvert as to create. It is therefore necessary to portray our commitment to human rights in pictures which are less open to corruption.
Did you say pictures less, not open to corruption?
That are less open to corruption. Yes.
Because it's something we actually were talking about in the car on the way over, is that notion of the strength in the images, the strength in the poetry, the strength in the words. So there is something actually in evil that needs to annihilate those things because of the power of it. And there was an innate belief, if not just a straight-out drive among the artists who were working in these places. And we can speak about the fear and the oppression that came because everybody was at tremendous risk. But can you talk a little more about the power that you saw as you went through this?
Yeah, actually, one of the most amazing things is, and I say this in the introduction, and it really dawned, it hit me over the head. It was like a sledgehammer after having gone through all these things. If you look at the history of the world, most of the most brutal dictators, the people who have been really good at controlling their environments, of usurping others' power, of scaring people, understood far better than we here in this free world about the power of the creative process, such that... you know, the Stasi in East Germany had a particular program to make sure that they knew where artists were, who artists were, and to make sure that they were not allowed to live in high concentration places together. Okay? Now, they understood that. In Chile, under Pinochet, when they started herding people into the soccer stadiums, there's an incredible singer, folk singer, named Victor Jara. Have you heard of his story? Okay. Victor Jara was an icon. And the regime thought, well, the best way to break the back of resistance is to mortify those icons in your community. So they brought him in front of thousands and thousands of intellectuals and artists in the stadium who had been rounded up. And they put him up on a podium and they said, "Sing. You know, we mandate that you sing." And he did sing. And as he sang, they started to cut his hands. And instead of stopping, he continued, and he continued, and he continued until he bled out. Of course, the idea there was that we need to strike first at the most dangerous place. And the most dangerous place was people who were asking difficult questions and using the creative process to make images and manifest ideas in ways that were incredibly powerful. And so, many of the artists in this book already had big lessons from the people who were the despots in their lives about the power of the creative process. And one of the most brilliant of those is Slobodan Milosevic. Slobodan Milosevic was a second-rate communist bureaucrat. But he knew something about the power of symbol. And so when he realized that the make-believe consortium of provinces that that Tito had put together was starting to fall apart, he decided he was going to create a mini sort of cult of personality around himself and create an obsessive us-them circumstance with Serbians and the rest of the population. And one of the ways that he did that was he went back in history and he found some clerics who had died many, many hundreds of years ago. He had them disinterred, proclaimed them martyrs, and marched them to Belgrade in a mass procession. And one of the most theatrically monumental events in Serbian history. And one of those, a couple of those events, really began his resurgence, his resurgence as a politician. He consistently used art and theater in order to basically create a xenophobic environment throughout Serbia. But the interesting thing is that he met his match in the protests in the squares that happened over the course of the 10 years that he held power. And one of the driving forces of that was this band of artists who, basically would use the creative process to speak back and to do things that were not only powerful but also humorous in the face of intimidation. And that's one of the most amazing things here. If you can imagine, one of the most powerful things that a despot can do is to force you to do something that will give them an excuse to repress you. And in Yugoslavia in particular, one of the things that kept happening over and over is that the provocation would happen and the resulting reaction would be comedic rather than fighting violence with violence. And in the book, there are a number of stories of how pretty brutal things were turned around into pretty silly things overnight. Pretty neat.
Yeah. The cover of the book, this image, which we find absolutely gorgeous and riveting, I don't know if you've seen it yet, but comes out of that theater company. And it was decided that it was going to be the cover image of the book because of the striking beauty of the image, the color red, and also the genuine defiance and spirit of aliveness that it conveyed in the face of all of this. I mean, here in Watts, the FBI infiltrated the writer's workshop, burned down the building. The writers kept writing. In Ireland, a woman's husband got beaten up. The people still got on the buses, went to the play. The peace process took place. People kept going. in face of it because of the belief, really. I think also that part of what comes out of this is there was a process of mentoring that was going on, and there was a process also of support and collaboration. Like Bud Schulberg stepped forward and put the writer's workshop in Watts, began to bring people together, didn't need to be in control of it. The writing went out in ripples in all kinds of ways. The woman from South Africa came to Boston, was part of the Boston Museum School, part of a print studio there. They continued to provide support. The way that the workshops were set up in Phnom Penh provided for mentoring. The students were brought in. They were well cared for. They were watched out for. The Watts Prophets took people under their wings. I was lucky enough to work in the Youth Authority with both Amdi and Richard and just watch the way that they would take care of who was there and go back in and visit. Can you talk some about the way that mentoring took place, the caring for the next generation?
Well, one of the things I think that's also striking here is that obviously none of these stories are stories that involve a great degree of resource. Okay, so a lot of people starting from scratch and continuing from scratch. If you think about the relationship of sort of the commodified and materialized art making and the opposite, the ego thing is really not gigantic. When you're working in an environment where, you know, basically the thing you are most afraid of is being paid too much attention to, whether it's by the authorities, you know, or causing too much of a ruckus with your artwork. So you know, there's a kind of a delicate balance between being an upfront, outfront, provocative art maker, and you know, basically trying to avoid being too provocative. One of the things that necessarily occurs then is what I would call spreading the wealth. And I mean, it is literally a tactic that is used in many revolutionary circumstances, which is to make sure that no one person is seen or actually has the power to make or break the endeavor. So lots and lots and lots of people end up being connected to the process, being brought into the process, being taught what to do. One of the most amazing things in the Cambodian story, which covers a period of time from 1969 to 2008, is that the I guess you would call one of the major characters, his name is Lee Darvuth, started out his journey as a 9-year-old in a Khmer Rouge camp, survived by his wits, escaped, got to France, ended up in the Sorbonne, ended up...
After being tagged that he would be a really good janitor.
Yes. And he was a terrible janitor, to be honest with you. He was awful at it. Teaching himself French, actually becoming a French scholar, actually becoming by the time he returned in 1996 to Cambodia, he was the second PhD in the country. Okay. Just to know, let me see, I think, how many of you all wear glasses? Let's see. Okay, so know that within the first 4 months of the Khmer Rouge time, you would all be dead. Or you would be wandering around like this. Most people got rid of their glasses pretty quickly, but that was one of the criteria that was used to define whether someone was an enemy, because if you had glasses, it meant that you probably could read. Reading was seen as a corrupting influence. But Darvuth, who started out obviously very young on his journey, by the time he comes around to 2004, 2005, Rayum, the organization he started, opened a school. And that school is for the next generation of refugees. But these are not refugees who have been displaced from their country. These are refugees that are internal, who live on the streets, the young people of Phnom Penh. A city of about 1.3 million at this point, that have an extraordinarily large number of young people who do not go to school, who don't have access to school, who do not have homes to live in. And they created an amazing school for these people, a collective of visual artists that, interestingly enough, how many of you are familiar with the work of Ako and Koma, the dancers? Okay, choreographers. Ako and Koma ended up spending a lot of time in Phnom Penh and turning this visual artist collective into a touring performing group that performed, I think they performed here, as a matter of fact. Cambodian Stories was the name of the performance. But Darvuth understood completely the power of the creative process to move these kids from potential criminal behavior into being some of the people who will probably lead their country. As that country attempts to move into a democratic environment, which is going to be a real struggle over the next 15 or 20 years.
Yes, the work actually leaves me speechless. And in reading the book, actually, it's led me to go and buy the DVD of the Cambodian Stories to look up the poems that are feeding this. One of the things that we talked about in my asking Bill about the book is that, what really was some of the criteria in picking the stories? And I'd worked on projects myself where there was actually a set number of people going to be held up visibly, and those were the stories that were going to be told. What happens to the ones that you didn't choose? And there's also something, he said, well, yes, there were places where there were stories that didn't get chosen, because even after visiting them for 3 years, I knew it was wrong. Well, Bill, what was wrong? They weren't from there. The people that were doing the work weren't from there. They were people of goodwill, but they had come from someplace else, and they weren't from there. They didn't understand it. And so there's something that you're talking about that comes up out of the heart and the culture of the country itself, out of the essential call, speaking of calling of spirits, call of the culture itself. And part of it was also, whether it's Northern Ireland, whether it's South Central, whether it's South Africa, that also was in the service of reconciliation. And in the service of reconciliation, in the face of great hatred, great oppression. And you talk about that. Part of in the book, one of this, you said that what the artist talked about was the need for protected space from people from both sides of the peace line to explore common ground. Is that what each of these stories opens? And the people that I know, certainly in this audience, do this as well, is to make that common grounds protected space possible, that art making has more impact than violence. And yet there is a big cost when it comes to doing reconciliation.
Well, actually, one thing to recognize is that the sort of sweep of motivation here is everything from fighting back to reconciliation, peacemaking, to, in the case of dealing with AIDS, changing worldview, literally changing people's perception of how the world works around you, using art to do that. And I would say, actually, I mean, the interesting thing is that if you, as you look at the the trajectory of these stories, often they start out at one place and end up way, way at a different place. I mean, I have to say that many of these people come with, given the circumstances, kind of a chip on their shoulder, being pissed off at circumstances and using that motivation and plowing it into the creative process to move from away from the tendency to destroy, which is something Vern McKee taught me about, which is you can go to that easy place. It's very easy to be angry enough and turn that anger into something that hurts or betrays or destroys. These are people that actually did the opposite in very, very, very assertive ways. So if you could imagine aggressive peacemaking, if you could imagine, I mean, one of the things that happened in Belgrade in the middle of all this stuff is performances in the squares provoking the spirit of Bertolt Brecht, talking about, yes, there will be singing in the dark times. Yes, there will be singing in the dark times. And letting people know that they have a choice. Every single one of them had a choice as to whether to believe the lie, which Milosevic was actually, it's amazing. There was, everybody here in this room probably was aware of the fact that there was a major, major, major violent conflict going on in the former Yugoslavia. At the same time, there was not one publication, official publication in Belgrade, in Serbia, that ever mentioned that there was a war going on, and the government completely denied that it was happening. So to go onto the square and to say, there is a war going on, but, you know, speaking in tongues rather than directly, not on a soapbox, but using Brecht to talk about peace, is an extraordinarily powerful and courageous thing to do. And not knowing what would happen to you, sort of looking over your shoulder, looking at those kinds of things. On the complete other end, if you think about the Pijinjara people coming out of this sort of nuclear Holocaust circumstance in Australia. These are people who had suffered five decades, at the hands of their own government, who refused to admit that anything untoward had occurred. To this day, they have not come clean. You know, at the bombing of the entire middle of Australia and all the terrible things, and basically creating work that does two things. This is amazing. Tells the story with respect to the people who have been victimized, and tells the story without pointing fingers, just telling the story in a way that people can embrace it. The people of Australia, not the government, the people of Australia. And this is, I mean, it's interesting because this is a piece that goes on, has gone on for the last 6 months. Yeah.
Hey, Bill.
Yeah.
My friend, Bill.
Yeah.
I'm going to do my job now.
Okay, go.
Because we want to save some time, I think, for the slides that are coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And we have some pretty amazing people sitting in front of us that I'm sure have some amazing questions.
Yeah.
Now, I stopped you. Is there something...
No, go. Yeah.
Because you actually handed me a line, which is that there will be singing in the dark. In the dark times. There will be singing in the dark times. So what we would like to do is show you, Bill would like to do is show you some of the images from the book. It is very hard to talk about creativity and art and not show you something. And it's actually my understanding that there's a theme song for this.
Yeah, I'll probably save it till the end.
You're going to save it till the end?
Yeah, and I'm only going to give you a couple of lines. but let me give you some of these images, see if we can get it to work. Okay, so it started with a wedding, right? This is, in fact, the wedding community play. The play started in two kitchen houses, which are what they call the houses in the community of Short Strand and Ballymacarette, who are Protestant and Catholic communities that are juxtaposing each other in Belfast. And they spent a year working with Protestants and Catholics who had not spent a lot of time talking to each other to create an amazing play that actually took place in the houses that they... Okay, so you got on a bus as a spectator, you went to the Catholic house, you went to the Protestant house, and you lived the 15 minutes prior to the wedding when everybody's running around with their heads cut off, right? Corsages, why did you do this to me? You know, this is the worst thing that ever happened. All these arguments. And then you go to the church. Everybody shows up at the church. Protestants on the right side, Catholics on the left, or maybe it was the other way around, I don't remember. And then you end up at the reception, which is in a reception hall at the top of a pub. And actually the amazing thing is that, here's the cast. The amazing thing is they left you to your own devices for 45 minutes prior to the reception part in the pub. So when you got there, now this is an interesting thing. This is what you would call sort of paramilitary tagging. And this was the major issue, and probably still is, and that is the issue of what's going to happen to the weapons. This next image is a Protestant paramilitary mural. There literally were thousands of murals in these communities that, in essence, celebrated their particular version of history and, in some cases, drew a dividing line. You can see here that there's one side that's kind of negative and the other side that's kind of nice. It's propaganda. While this play was happening, this vote, which was the first vote by the Ulster Unionist Party to join the Northern Ireland Assembly, was taking place. And in the last minute that the play was happening, the vote was affirmative. It was an extraordinary moment to be there. Now, that process has gone on over and over, and we seem to be in a pretty good place with it, so I'm really happy. Da Theater in Serbia. This is an image of that first performance that they performed, okay? And this happened in the middle of the war, and those men in the background... you can't see it, but a couple of them have machine guns. So this is a kind of interesting performance venue. And they had no idea what was going to happen to them. They did come out of it. But this is a public space where this happened. This is something that we were involved in. Anybody know what this is? It's the bombing of Belgrade. Okay, it's very interesting to go visit a place that your planes have bombed. And it was a lot more damage than we saw in our news. It was very confusing for the people of Belgrade who've been fighting against Milosevic all that time. Actually, the Da Theater had to cancel their classes for kids due to local bombing. This was their answer to the bombing, which was these two old women that went back and forth up and down the stairs to the National Library, bringing the books of wisdom up and down the stairs, blowing dust off them, finally coming to grips that the answers to the perplexing questions that face us all, they may be informed by those old books, but we're going to have to take responsibility and write new chapters for those books. And this was the denouement, the sort of end of the road for Milosevic. And this is the burning of the Parliament building. It wasn't burned too bad, but many of the people in that crowd were artists who were at the forefront of the change in regime that took place. And here is that picture. Beauty in the midst of betrayal and destruction and violence. If anybody had an excuse to do something ugly in response to ugly, and this is what Da did, one of the things they did. This is Sanja Tasek, that's one of the artists. Art for Humanity, South Africa. These are some of those images of the Bill of Rights. I'll just let them run through. They're all black and white, linoleum prints. One of the striking things about the revolution in South Africa is that it was a truly multiracial revolution. That white folks, brown folks, what they call colored, black, all suffered and all came to the fore. And these images were made by artists of all parts of the community. It's a great one. Freedom of movement and residence. There's your turtle. Fantastic. Access to courts. Great work. Really great work. These guys are no stranger to you all, the Watts Prophets. This was one of the precipitating events, of course, in their story. Watts Rebellion, 1965. This is Johnny Scott, Harry Dolan, who were two of the early artists, early writers. Harry Dolan actually ended up as the director. There's Bud Schulberg. And they're actually testifying at the U.S. Congress, talking about the power of art in the process of rebuilding the aftermath of the upheaval. This is, many of you familiar with Maverick Flat? Okay, this is an icon in your community. This is a place, this is a major place in your community where art making happened. Believe it or not, this was a what you might call a nightclub, okay, where the Four Tops and Martha and the Vandellas and Richard Pryor all showed up. Guess what? No alcohol. Families went in there all the time. And the Watts Prophets, for about 16 weeks, actually were kind of like the house band. Imagine a group of poets as the house band. It's fantastic. This is one of their first discs. Of course, it was a disc back then, right? But it was an actual record. And the word rappin' is used. This is long before it was used to attach itself to a genre of music. This was the first time. They were pissed off. And here's, they were poets. They moved through many stages. This is the Prophets as griots, self-described as griots. These are the ones who go back into the community and work with these kids as mentors in very quiet ways. Many of you heard of the Hip Hop Poetry Choir that happened here in LA. Incredible, incredible event. Rayum in Cambodia. This is one of those images, okay? Not very many images were ever painted, photographed of the actual presence of the Khmer Rouge. This was an act of great courage to paint this, to document that this actually happened. The guy who runs Cambodia right now actually was a Khmer Rouge commander who, at the right moment, decided to change stripes. So, talking about that history is not particularly well received. But there it is. This is a pretty interesting piece. This was a piece that was painted in response to questions about the future. Okay? And as you can see, the future, at least from this person's perspective, was both confusing, perplexing, and frustrating. These are those kids, the Rayum Art School. This is some of their visual art. Now, these are street kids. These are kids that spend pretty much all day painting so that they don't spend all day on the street. So this is the piece. These are shots from the piece that they did with Eko and Koma. These are shots from the piece that they did in Phnom Penh. They eventually toured it, and it became much more technologically sophisticated. But these are just done on a sand stage out back of the Rayum Art School. Now, one of the amazing things here is that this is a dance in which a massive piece of visual art is created as a part of the dance. They build a scaffold in the middle of the stage, and they come out, and they paint right there. So you'll see the outcome These are all young people who, in many ways, are looking for a mother.
I just want to save time for questions.
Okay. All right. So this is the piece that they created. And Napajee Napajee, this is the Aboriginal story of what happens in the aftermath of the atomic bomb. This is Trevor Jameson, whose family's story is told. These are the kids who create the language course online that you were required to take before you went to see the play because you can't tell the story without the language. This is Trevor's family on stage. This is Trevor in the final scene. Time for questions.
We'll open up for questions. And of the people that I just went by and said first names, like Judy Baca, premier LA muralist, Lydia Nicole, is an amazing actress and writer. Karen I didn't say it because I was going to forget, who has been making a documentary on Desmond Tutu in South Africa. Beth Thielen, who's one of the most extraordinary artists, has worked in the California prison system for years. Sheila Scott Wilkinson, who runs Theater of Hearts, has an extraordinary collection of artworks made by students from her programs from all over LA. Was lucky enough to be work with me at Arts Reach. Not I was lucky enough to work with Sheila at Arts Reach. She was a member of our theater company. And Will Alexander, who's a wonderful poet, are here. So sorry for the quick questions.
Comments. Jill, go for it.
Did the way you were perceived as American when you traveled change as our political climate changed over the last 8 years as Bush became more of a problem?
Well, actually, one thing I think you have to recognize is that every single one of these stories has American fingerprints indelibly on it, whether behind the scenes or in the scenes. So even the Australian story has an American impulse. So the current contemporary history, most of the people around the world are much more aware of our history than we are. And they're particularly aware of the part of our history that had a major impact on their lives. And so to say the least, a white guy from America, the first entrees, I assumed would not be one of overwhelming trust. That's why it took 8 years to write this book. And that's why it took the time that it took to go and visit, and people understood that I wasn't going to go away. You should know, and they certainly did know, that there isn't a word in here that wasn't vetted by the people who are represented here. That was a covenant that I made with every single one of them. And we went back and forth and back and forth many times. One very interesting thing that happened, very similar to this, is that, as you know, these histories were not static. They were ongoing. So, for example, in Northern Ireland, we started out, we were in the middle of this hiatus that was created by the Mitchell Accords, and everybody was optimistic. So I send them a draft of the transcript, of the manuscript for their part, and they say, this is great. This celebrates our triumph, you know, doing this great work. 3 months later, the whole thing falls to pieces. They email me back, we've changed our mind. What we did was a travesty. They literally said that. We feel that we betrayed our community doing this work. Then, 3 months later, they emailed me back again to say, well, we're sort of in the middle now. And part of this was like this work was a reflection of the ongoing changing psyche of the environments in which they were in. And finally, I had to actually incorporate in the text the fact that the people who are portrayed here have a very difficult time reaching conclusions about their own work, and those reading should also understand that History is a mutating, moving target, and that the readings are multiple, and we need to respect the fact that, you know, that actually it is, you know, it's an organic thing, and it's always going to be alive. And it was really actually, I can tell you as a writer, it's very difficult to have someone tell you yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. Yeah. Beth.
Will. Yeah, would you think that this is like a tentative movement towards maybe a shift in the civilization from a left brain to a right brain, the first tentative movements, changing the neurology and the general paradigm shift?
If anything's tentative, it is that this stuff has existed massively across the world. The thing that's been tentative is our capacity of our cultural radar to register it. The reason I wrote this book is to just give some voice to these incredible stories. But I got to tell you, my computer is full to bursting with the thousands and thousands of artists around the world who are doing this kind of work. This is the way people deal with these circumstances. This is something that happens. Human beings are built to do this in the face of upheaval. This is what people do. This is how people heal. This is how people tell their stories. This is how people manifest truth to power. In many ways, and I use this phrase often more now than later, but we are in the confluence of the tyranny of comfort and the tyranny of the urgent. And the casualty has been the imagination. So for the last 8 years, if not more, this country has been suffering from a failure of imagination. People around the world have a lot to teach us about how to recover our imaginative powers in order to deal with the challenges that we are facing in the next 6 to 12 months. So these are stories, contemporary stories, for particularly Americans to learn from.
Beth was next, I think.
Hi, guys. Could you dream with me a little bit on in this next phase of here in this country? I know you've both been in the trenches when there's been a lot of creative sparks in California in particular that built some great artistic movements here, and then you've also seen it ebb. But from your perspective, could you kind of dream and maybe throw in some little practical advice about how we're going to get through this?
Oh, yeah, easy. Go ahead, Susan.
Well, as the great Rebecca Rice was said, you just do the work. I believe you just do the work. I have to say that I'm sort of brain dead in terms of resurgence. We have the Brain Trust of the Social and Public Art Resource Center here, who I know has some things afoot. Certainly my hope is that books like this are going to make an impact and begin to validate the kind of work that we know that gets done. Basically, I just look at the opportunities. I just look at the opportunities and step forward.
So here's a piece of practice. On January 20th, 2009, we're going to have a change in this country. The change is not going to be a new president. There will be a new president. The change will be that somebody's going to be turning around and asking you to take some responsibility for your community, for the country and for your community. One of the things I know that happens here is when people read about this, they go, oh, how can we help them? Okay. Well, I encourage those of you who buy this book, who want to contribute to Rayum and contribute to Da, please do. But I think the best response here is to basically ask the question, where is the place that I will manifest this power in the same way they did? Okay, where is my responsibility? Where's the place that I can manifest this power in a way that starts to change people's worldview, that starts to surface stories that have been hidden? And then, in fact, starts to move us from us-them oppositional work into the we work that is desperately needed. And that's one of the most amazing. If these people can do this in this place, man, I mean, we got some fields to plow here. We're going to have a great garden if we get to work. And I believe that that's, you know, there's a recipe for fertilizer in here that you all can just whip up.
Let's see, with Karen, was Karen next? Whose hand is here, and Judy?
Okay. Hi. I appreciated so much what Susan referred to in your process of selecting stories, the concept that the things that you wanted to lift up were very authentic, grounded. Can you talk a little bit more about that when you say they weren't from there? What do you see as problematic in that, and what might be other approaches for people who are good-hearted and want to make a difference? Mm-hmm.
Well, what I don't want to do is draw a false dichotomy between people who are not from there and people who are from there. It's just different. It's different work. And when you look at the stretch of this work, there are different categories. There is a whole tradition of folks from the Western world going to other parts of the world to do good work, and they do great work. I was interested in work that was grounded in the history from which it came. That meant, in many of these cases, 40 years or more. There aren't a whole lot of people from outside the community who stick around for 40 years. That's number one. Number two is, no matter how effective you are as an outsider, the vested interest, and particularly dealing with issues like Catholic artists and Protestant artists who are pissed off at each other too. You know, they're not just walking around with an art-infused, peaceful heart and trying to turn other people onto it. They're angry too. So they're dealing, and they understand the animosities that are there. The same thing in Cambodia, you know, the victim as creator, you know, or the victim as, I will not be a victim in this circumstance. I will transcend that label that the world wants to put on me, is a very different story and a very different way of making art and a very different way of engaging the world. The other thing is that my sense, I wanted stories that personified the real history, or, you know, and these folks had not only their own lifetimes, but the lifetimes of their parents and their parents' parents, et cetera, et cetera. They went way back. So they were able to say, well, you know, actually, this didn't just happen overnight. And they allowed me, I thought, particularly through the eye of other artists, to really get a clear sense of the link between history and culture and then the healing piece, and how they're all connected. And in many cases, those sutures were not going to be made by people from the outside. They had to be people who were actually wielding them on themselves. And boy, they taught me a lot. And the other thing I understood very deeply is that if the trust wasn't forged for them to tell the story, I would never get the story. So these are the keepers of the story. And if they didn't trust me enough to share the story, then I needed to leave, you know. And that was the sort of the proof in the pudding, I guess.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.